those who may not have heard of him before or don't know any of the particulars, and I'll keep it short so that those of you who do won't have to listen to it again for too long. We've been doing a lifestyle tutorial on Escape from Evil, which is the last book he wrote and actually was published after his death. The Denial of Death won a Pulitzer Prize, which was also awarded posthumously, and that is a particular irony for Becker, since he talked about immortality projects and such and wasn't even attained this great recognition in his lifetime. He was a professor, and he was at Berkeley during the time when Mario Savio was doing the free speech thing. And he got into some trouble there by identifying with the minority, namely the students and a few of the professors. And he was a very popular professor, and his classes were large. And consequently, he was not very well liked by the rest of the faculty. And so they terminated his contract, and the students got together $13,000 or something like that to fund a chair for him to, you know, to continue, but the university wouldn't allow it. So he went to San Francisco State or something like that, where Hayakawa was. He's a very conservative character, and he was there for 2 years. And then he went finally to Simon Fraser University in Canada, and that's where he continued until his illness prevented further work. He died in 1974. I want to do a little bit of just general, I'm going to try to do a little bit of general background on these books and then develop maybe one or two themes, and maybe that'll be a way for us to, for you and for me too, to get a window into his whole thinking. And perhaps you'll be moved to go and buy these books, which are in the bookstore. I really recommend them. And they're much better the second time, and they get, you know, as they age, they get better. I'm on my third time on some of this stuff, and it still hasn't gone flat by any means. The Denial of Death is a very good phrase to remember with respect to Becker. He, in this book, talks about the individual person mostly. And in this book, Escape from Evil, he takes the ideas in here and generalizes them to a onto a historical level and a societal, cultural level. His thesis is that all of us and all of our culture and all of history, in fact, hinges on man's fear of death, his wish to deny death, and his need to grab for immortality in any way that he can. And in this one, he talks about Freud some. He talks about Otto Rank, whom he relies on greatly in both of these books. He views Rank in this way, that Rank read all the many writings about man and then tried to pull it all together. In other words, there's a fragmentation. There's people going off in this field here doing a little thing in anthropology, and there's someone over here doing a thing in history, and there's someone over here doing a thing in psychology, but there's no agreement about man in the widest, most general way. He says, is man basically good or is man evil? There's absolutely no agreement. It's split down the middle, you know. And so he develops he talks about Rousseau, who held that man was basically good, or at least born neutral, if not good. And then it's the evil society that makes us, you know, turn out the way we shouldn't. And then on the other hand is someone like Freud, who feels that we have basically aggressive insides, or we seek to have pleasure and we'll trample people to get, you know, pleasure or to have the joy of aggression or so on. So he would hold that people are not very good. They're certainly not neutral. And these two stand off against each other. Marx follows in the tradition of Rousseau in feeling that it's society that pushes man into a bad pattern. If society can be reformed, then man will flower and bloom. And so he in here talks about the union of Marx and Freud. Marx on the one hand saying man would be okay if only society would get straightened out, and Freud on the other hand saying that we can barely manage to get along without violent aggression and trampling on each other. In fact, he quotes Freud. I shouldn't maybe say this because It's a particularly, I think, unpleasant quote, but I think it's quite revealing, too. He says, Freud in here is quoted in one place as saying that most people that he's known are trash. And I thought that was an astounding statement. And Becker goes on to say, you can bet that we know at least one person who isn't in that, you know, in that category. And this is our problem, you know. This is what Becker's talking about. We've all got to relate to some kind of a power source. It's when he stops relying maybe on some of the more traditional thinking, at least as far as my knowledge extends. He starts to talk about how we need a power source to stand in to gain some kind of a firm footing so that we can feel right, and therefore feel like possible candidates for immortality. And this is not just what we think of as a narrow religious phenomenon, because he would say that the communists deny God and so on, but they're struggling to be good and to be right, and they're principled, you know, and they want a power source to stand in, and they have arguments about who's the true Leninist, you know, who's really following Marx and Lenin, and who's a counter-revolutionary, see? So they've got their orthodoxy and their heresy. Just, you know, it's like a religion. And all of us need to be right. And so, and he starts out and in one place talking about power and says that as children, this is one of our first preoccupations, we learn where the power is. We need to know where the power is. We are powerless. And everything around us has got all this power. Certainly our parents do. And if we have older siblings, they do. And as we go out to school, there's a lot more power categories. And we've got to learn, you know, we've got to find out about that. He says, if you're wrong about power, you don't get a chance to be right about anything else. You know, you learn that trucks out in the street have a lot of power. And your mother is going to make sure that you know that. And if you're wrong about that, if you forget about that, that's the end of the story. And so we have to learn about power. And that continues. It doesn't stop when we're 6 or 10 or 15, but it keeps on. And one of the reasons it keeps on is that the most power you could possibly have would make you immortal. God has that kind of power. You know, he lives on and on. And we would have that kind of power too. And so we continue to be obsessed with power. And just as a sort of a footnote to that, he talks about the origin of classes, and he says the first class division was between the immortal gods and we mortals. When men started to talk about the gods and had them on the immortal plane, then that was the first class division. They were the, you know, they were the upper class. They were, you know, where we all wanted to be, and we're down here. And then that spreads out, and people who represent the gods then get a share of that. And so then they're, you know, they're set in the middle somewhere between the gods and the rest of us down here, as the case may be. And then later on, that subdivides again. Maybe the king represents the gods, and then the father in Rome represents the king, and so then he's got power, and it sort of spreads down like that, and you get all these divisions. Well, that's a whole discussion in itself. Okay, so power is one of his categories, and our wish to have it. Then he talks about also, he spends a lot of time talking about guilt and the expiation of guilt. Suppose you get power, suppose you have power, and you use that power in some way. Maybe you, he talks about primitive cultures. You're a great hunter, and so you go out and you kill an animal and you bring it back. This is an example of your power. But as a powerful person, you're also a threat to your fellows. And you feel guilty about that because it doesn't feel good to stick out and to be an oddball in a sense, to be exceptional. That used to bug me a little bit when the educationists began to speak of exceptional children and include both the very bright and the very dull. But I think that fits in well with what Becker's saying here. To be exceptional is to sort of stick out in one direction or the other, and it doesn't feel good. And so maybe you're a great hunter, and you bring back this thing, although you feel good about it, and you like being powerful, and you think that this has perhaps made you a candidate for honors, you also feel guilty about it. That's one way that guilt comes about. And so maybe the expiation for the guilt is you let the others come and have the choice cuts of the animal, and you take sort of one of the lesser parts. And that way you get to have your cake and eat it too, in a sense, although you may not to get your steak. But, you know, you have to settle for the liver or something. But or maybe that's the choice part, I don't know, for some of you. But you get to have your power and the feeling good about that, and you also get to expiate the guilt by letting others have the choicer parts. Well, this need continues. He speaks of the guilt of being. And in a sense, if it feels bad to stick out and be not fit in, then all of us have that problem. He talks about the human face. He says, look around the faces. They all are very individual. So all of us are individual. In a sense, all of us stick out. It's dangerous to have a head, he says, because it makes you stick out of the crowd in some way. And so all of us are guilty. We had a movie, The Pawnbroker, here. And the pawnbroker in the film was trying to avoid, I would say, he was trying to avoid being responsible for anyone else. He was completely closed in on himself, and all he wanted to be was just left alone. He didn't want anybody in his world. He didn't want them to want him in their world. Just leave me alone, right? And I've had times like that, you know, when I felt miserable and I needed help, but if anybody came to me, I'd just say, leave me alone. Well, that's the way he was all the time. But what happened was, as he lived, other people were destroyed by this man. Because what he was doing doesn't work. The things that he did to the people around him, the things that he said, and what resulted from that ended in their destruction. And guilt for him was inevitable. He couldn't stand any more of it, and yet he couldn't avoid it either. And the more he tried to avoid it, the worse it got. I think that all of us perhaps have got a little smidgen of guilt in us because we came into a family and things sort of shook around us as we did. And as we grew, they continued to shake. Paul Bauermeister was here this last spring, and he talked about the family as a balancing act. And he had mother and dad up here sort of leaning back against each other in a balance. Now suddenly you add a youngster to it. The whole balance shifts, you know. It can't stay the same anymore. It changes. One way or another, that youngster is going to be included. And all of us were that youngster at one time or another. And we feel we've probably got a residual of guilt. And it stays with us because when we go other places too, you know, we have an effect on each other. And that's as it should be. But sometimes we feel guilty about it. And so the point is that guilt is, in a sense, inevitable. He criticizes Freud because Freud wanted to talk about neurotic guilt, that is, misplaced guilt. And he perhaps said, I don't know Freud that well, but I take it from Becker, that Freud perhaps thought that all guilt was neurotic, that it could be analyzed away. And Becker's response to that is, you know, no way. It can't be analyzed away because we've all got these binds that we're living in, and they result in guilt. And so there's a need for expiation of that guilt in some way. Okay, so guilt is one of his big categories. And let's see, I had one more here. No, I've done that. Okay. Okay, now, I want to do a thing on psychology, but maybe I should stop first and just... I don't even know if there's enough of a picture to even ask about now. It's hard to get into Becker, and so maybe it's very hard for you to pick up anything. What, any questions or comments, or should I just continue? Just, yeah.
The guilt you're just referring to, I don't know how Becker, what kind of plane he works within, if it ties in religion or anything, but is this guilt, you gave reasons for it, how about like original sin? Does that come together with it at all?
I think so. When I read Escape from Evil, I keep being reminded of Genesis and the story of the creation and fall. And it has come to just dominate my impression of this book. Becker is a little ambiguous with respect to religion, for several reasons, I think. First of all, he was born in a Jewish family. He had a time of atheism when he rejected it all, and then he came back again to God. He believed in God. He corresponded with a Christian pastor, and the letters are quite interesting. He says in one of them that maybe Christ is the shape of man, and is to be the shape of man, and so on. But in these books, he's writing from a scientific standpoint, and I think he's writing to a scientific community, mostly. And so he stays away from that kind of talk. He mentions religion. He talks about religion, certainly. And he says that, for instance, all power is sacred power because it has to do with getting immortality. And that's what religion is about, too. Being right with the power. Sin, he defines, as feeling unsure about how you stand with respect to the power, God. You know, sin is to be out of tune or unsure, at least unsure, of how you stand with God. And so he definitely talks about those things, but not from the inside, say, of Christianity, for example. But he speaks about it more as a psychological or a sociological happening. I have mixed feelings about that, but I'm finding it more and more satisfying as I read him. I didn't think I would. At first, it sort of rubbed me wrong. But he has so many true perceptions that I think there must be something to it, what he's doing. Now, he doesn't use the phrase original sin, you know. But I almost have to, you know, I keep having the feeling that he had the creation story right over there in his desk the whole time he wrote this book. It's just full of it, you know.
To be able to answer my question, but you said there was Rousseau and Marx were kind of similar, and then there was Freud.
Yeah.
And I don't really understand where Becker's coming from in regards as to if man's basically all right, neutral, or if he's basically evil.
Right. That's a very good question, and as I was talking about that, I sort of realized that question was there, and I let it go, you know. He talks in Escape from Evil about having a science of man that will facilitate a saner world, a more sane world for our children, he says in one place. Again, he says there's nothing, if his analysis is right, he says there's nothing in man that forbids utopian dreams, in a sense. But the catch is how difficult it is to get loose from this fear of death and the need to deny it and the need to grab for immortality. And his answer, insofar as he puts forth an answer, he takes from several places. He has a chapter in Denial of Death on Kierkegaard. And he talks about Kierkegaard's idea of needing to believe in God, letting anxiety lead you to faith. In other words, you've got this anxiety about these things, and finally it's your school. And finally you give up. You cannot guarantee your own immortality. You can't create it. You cannot find it. And so you come to faith, finally, in a God who loves, and the fear of death becomes inoperable, in a sense. You no longer need to grab for immortality. If that were happening, then heaven would happen, perhaps. Okay. Some of this is his words, and some of them are words that I think are his, and some of them are mine. I'm sort of mixing it all together. Let me read something that is very much to the point, a little different. He speaks of heroism too, and to be a hero is to get, you know, to excel in some way, to get a chunk of this immortality. And there's so much left out, you know, because like culture, see, our culture is the way we get together to try to get immortality. That I have to say that first of all, or this quote may not make any sense. And so groups, you know, have sort of group immortality. I'm going to die, but the United States or the Lutheran Church or Holden Village will continue. Okay. Holden. I mean, I'll leave Holden, but it will continue, you know. And as long as Holden is here, then I'm safe out there, something like that. I've done a little bit of that, you know. I know how that goes. In fact, when I was in Kenora, Ontario, Canada, for a year, working at a church up there, I was telling some people about the village. And when I spoke of the village, I said, we. And this guy said, well, this is very curious, you know. You've left the village, but you're speaking of the village as we, you know. We do this or we do that, see. And I was sharing in, you know, what this place sort of has meant to me and sort of holding me up, you know. Well, cultural projects are like that. And culture, all culture is like that, he says. Anyway, so you can be a culture hero, you know, a military hero, or perhaps a great consumer would be one way to be a cultural hero these days, or a producer maybe too. But a new heroism he speaks of here, the heroism of sainthood. This meant living in primary awe at the miracle of the created object, including oneself in one's own godlikeness. Then he speaks of Saint Francis, who looked at a bird, a flower, and saw infinity in these things, see? It also meant unafraidness of one's own death because of the incomparable majesty and power of God. And so religion overcomes the specific problem of fear-stricken animals, us, while at the same time showing them what empirical reality really is. Because, see, that's the other side of it. Creation is majestic and awesome, and it's frightening and terrible. See? If we were not fear-stricken animals who repressed awareness of ourselves in our world, then we would live in peace and unafraid of death, trusting to the Creator God and celebrating His creation. The ideal of religious sainthood, like that of psychoanalysis, is thus the opening up of perception. This is where religion and science meet. And then, immediately after, but I am not saying that the science of society is merged into organized religion. Far from it. And then he goes on to say how it is.
What was the question?
Go ahead.
Well, that's true what he said. I mean, there are people, maybe some people here, that say that they don't have any fear because they do trust in the Creator God. And so, but still, when people are not living in perfection and things aren't perfect, and everyone's not peaceful and happy.
One little thing that reminds me of is close with approval. There probably are a lot of things that might be said. That's a tough one, though, because he doesn't discuss it directly, at least not that I recall. But in his chapter in Kierkegaard here, he talks about the anxiety leading to faith. But then he says, not that this is easy, and not that it is an easy out for man or a cure-all for the human condition. Kierkegaard is never facile, he says. He gives a strikingly beautiful idea, and then he quotes Kierkegaard. Not that faith annihilates anxiety, but remaining ever young, it is continually developing itself out of the death throes of anxiety. So we're constantly in this, but faith is the orientation that takes us to heaven, all right? And heaven is my word, not his. Does that address itself? I think it does, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Yeah. When he has this kind of a man trying to grab, plug into the power, whatever, if you look at him as good and evil, as good, and would he define that as good being that which plugs you into the power, and evil being that which doesn't plug you into the power, or, you know, does he make a definition, you know, from his theory about...
Yeah, that's a good question. That's right at the, you know, it's one of his very basic things too. That's a term really that I should have talked about a bit, particularly since it's in the title here, the escape from evil. And I'm going to use my idea that he's basing, not basing it, but it goes along so nicely with the Eden myth, I would say. In Eden, man and woman, Adam and Eve, right? Were told not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But they did. And God said, you'll surely die. And so on, right? Now, what happened was man gained the knowledge of good and evil. And so, and we define evil, he says, Becker says, as that which threatens our life, first of all, and that which threatens it both, you know, in an immediate sort of a way, like no food, for example, you know, or someone coming at you to wipe you out, or in more slow ways, like disease, for example, or just maybe being poor. Well, yeah. Eventually, but it threatens our mortality. I mean, you know, it's very immediate, right? And later on, this builds to the other too. And so we try to get, you know, some safety for ourselves. And each culture tries to do this. In other words, man was communal from the beginning, he would say. And so each group worked together to work out their lives and, you know, to prolong their lives and to prolong the life of their group. And so, you know, and so you get, and you've got a thing with power, and you've got to find out if the gods like you or not. If they like you better than that group that lives over there on the other side of the hill, you know. So you go over and you have a war. And of course, primitive wars weren't like our wars, but, you know, they were sort of like a game or a contest. But if you happen to get caught, your death was no, you know, was no game. It was very real. But so, you know, so you get this. And what the point is that the reason for the war was to get good things. You know? To have life, to have power, to have good standing with one's gods. If you like, you can, you know, you can talk about the Old Testament and the gods admonishing of his people to go in there and really wipe out those folks, you know. It's a very troublesome thing for some of us, I think. Troublesome for me, too. But the evil comes from somebody else's good. And so he would say the escape from evil is when we no longer need to grab for immortality, which is a hopeless project anyway, see? Then the source of evil is cut off. It's a whole different way of looking at it, sort of, you know. It's an evil... Now, Becker doesn't say this, and my people in the tutorial won't let me say it either, but I'll try it again. He says evil comes from trying to avoid evil. He does say that. He says that. Evil comes when we try to avoid evil. It probably comes to, you know, like when I'm trying to avoid evil, my evil, that is, you're a threat to my ego, or you're better off than I am, you know, in some way or other, and that threatens me. I mean, I want to compare myself to all of you, you know. I want to be just enough of a cut above you so that I think I'm a candidate for, you know, for goodies from heaven. And you know, if you threaten me in any way, then I'm going to come down against you or try to chop you down in some way. But it's all because so that I can avoid evil and get good, see? The best of motives, right? See? Evil comes from my trying to avoid evil, and you're trying to avoid evil. That's what he said.
Amen.
Wait.
No, I'm going to have to tell you this question.
So is there no evil if we don't try to avoid evil?
That's a possible conclusion. I don't know that he says it in so many words, but I think it's a logical outcome of his argument. I'm not going to try to be... She asked me, does evil go away when we no longer... Is there no more evil?
No, I said...
Yeah, how do you say
it? I said, so there's no evil if we don't try to avoid it. Like, what do you think? The chicken or the egg.
Chris and I had a long standing argument on this. It's a question of whether there's, you know, I don't know. This is a long thing. Yeah,
John. Evil is what that which threatens my life.
Evil, disease or...
Disease,
death,
and lack of prosperity.
How about consciousness?
You mean, is consciousness evil?
Consciousness threatens my life.
Well, say more.
In other words, I become a threat to myself.
Consciousness is a threat to taxes and costs or what?
I'm not...
Did he deal with that stuff? I know when they talked about the fall, what happened in the fall was self-conscious.
Yeah. Because I've got some problems with all that. First of all, I'm not sure that I know Becker well enough to represent Becker at that point. A couple of things I'm reminded of. One thing is that he definitely talks about the dying of the self. He definitely talks about that. And how to be wrong about things equals to die. Because when I'm wrong, that means I got off the track, I'm not in tune with God, and therefore I'm going to die. In fact, I'm already dead, you know, because I'm wrong. And the anxiety, then, you know, of that makes me try to build, to make myself safe. And yet the only way out of that is to die. And he quotes Kierkegaard extensively on this point. And and how it's necessary to not to try to deny death and all these things, you know, that are happening. In fact, I can find it here. One of the okay. He who is educated, this is Kierkegaard, he who is educated by dread is educated by possibility. When such a person, therefore, goes out from the school of possibility and knows more thoroughly than a child knows the alphabet, that he demands of life absolutely nothing, and that terror, perdition, annihilation dwell next door to every man, and has learned the profitable lesson that every dread which alarms may the next instant become a fact. In other words, you know, it's not don't worry about it, but it's that if you're worrying about it, there's probably a good reason for worrying about it, you know. But that's all right. He will then interpret reality differently, however. In other words, nobody could live in a world, you know, without standing in God in that kind of a condition. You couldn't possibly. Every threat, everything that you fear is imminently going to happen. You know, or at least there's a good likelihood that it's going to. If not, it's not because it isn't close enough to you. And so Kierkegaard then, apparently, and John and others who know Kierkegaard will have to forgive me at this point and indulge, you know, my ignorance of Kierkegaard, but he apparently then has it that's dread or anxiety schools us and we come to faith or else we go to destruction, one or the other at that point. So that's, I think, one thing, but I'm not at all sure that Becker himself does anything more than look at that. I'm not sure that he does it. I don't know. I'm not sure if that applies to what you're saying, John. But I think that he sees that happening. He recognizes talk about it. He struggles with it in his letters, for example, which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to read but once.
One thing is better. His refusal ever theology. It's important to think that some people refuse to enter theology out of a feeling of necessity that I can't. Choose not to. Could whoever chooses not to. It's different from being like God. It's not a possibility. Does that make any sense?
Possibly.
I mean, he chooses. I mean, he can very well choose not to talk about dimension through everything that he's writing.
But yeah,
he's capable of doing it, but he chooses not to.
That's the scientist's way for the scientist.
Never goes outside the house into the empirical reality to explain anything that happens inside the house. It makes it difficult to understand the water coming out of the taps, lights going on. But anyway, maybe the sense that he wants to talk about these subjects in the house and therefore cannot go thinking to have any reference to them.
Let me, I think possibly this other thing in psychology addresses itself to this, from the denial of death. Let me give it a little bit of background, and then, you know, stay with that and see whether this addresses itself to that. But someone who was an atheist, and he said that, however, Freud had his investment in what he was doing. Psychoanalysis was his project, that was his contribution to the world. Becker says, this is perfect. It means that Freud, too, was not exempt from the need to fit himself into a scheme of cosmic heroism.
an immortality ideology that had to be taken on faith. This is why Rank saw the need to go beyond psychology. It cannot by itself substitute for a hero system unless it is, as it was for Freud, the hero system. In other words, then you've got to be a psychologist in order to reach immortality. But psychology itself, he says, is not the way that we, all of us, are going to get to heaven. And he talks about psychological man, and he talks about how this is sort of the time of psychological man. All of us, you know, can read How to Analyze Yourself in 10 Years of Lessons, you know, in the Sunday supplement through the newspaper. We're all sort of experts on, you know, inferiority complexes or Oedipus complex now there's all sorts of weird cultic kinds of psychologies that come out, primal scream or gestalt or, I don't know, goes on and on and on, counter groups, et cetera, et cetera, you know. It's a wild flowering of this kind of stuff. And he talks about psychological man. He says, first of all, that what happened was the inner life of man had always been portrayed as the soul, the area of the soul. But in the 19th century, scientists wanted to reclaim this last domain of superstition from the church. So they came in to make the inner life of man an area free of mystery and subject to the laws of causality. They gradually abandoned the word soul and began to talk about the self. He says, it was Otto Rank who saw that this scientific victory raised more problems than it solved. Science thought it had gotten rid forever of the problems of the soul by making the inner world the subject of scientific analysis. But few wanted to admit that this work still left the soul perfectly intact as a word to explain the inner energy of organisms. Now he says, we still haven't explained the inner forces of evolution that have led to the development of an animal capable of self-consciousness. That's one of the things you talked about, was self-consciousness. We still haven't explained the inner forces of evolution. We haven't explained the inner forces of evolution that have led to the development of an animal capable of self-consciousness. Now that's a very, you know, careful empirical statement talking about forces of evolution, etc. But, you know, what in the world are those forces of evolution, right? Maybe I'm too kind, huh? Or maybe I do feel like defending him, you know, but anyway. Which is what we still must mean by soul, he says. Then, he goes on, he says, psychology could help us to get rid of false badness, hang-ups, you know, that dissolve when they're looked at, sort of. He defines false badness as the conflicts artificially caused by one's own early environment and the accidents of birth and place. These things can be gotten rid of, he says. Maybe it isn't easy, but it can be done. And, you know, this is teaching about how we were all formed by the time we were six, you know. There's no point trying to change because, you know, what you are, and that's it. And he won't go with that. He won't go with that. This is neurotic guilt, the false badness. Neurotic guilt can be gotten rid of, but the guilt of being, that can't be gotten rid of, he would say. These are called, another words he uses are circumstantial guilt. Exaggerated guilt, unscrutinized personal guilt, as over and against this other kind, which he calls real or natural creature guilt. Okay, now, psychology, he goes on to say, which is trying to supplant religion and moral ideology, is only partially qualified to do this because it is preponderantly negative and disintegrating ideology. It takes apart. It takes apart and criticizes, but it cannot put back together. And then he says this, all the analysis in the world doesn't allow the person to find out who he is and why he is here on earth, why he has to die, and how he can make his life a triumph. Analysis cannot do that. And so then he goes on to say how psychoanalysis and psychological help can make more of a problem sometimes. And I thought that was interesting. Can I go on to do that? Is it good, or do you want to interject a question? He says, let's see. What happens is, if we need God, and we do, and he says that, if psychology explains away guilt, or God, rather, then it doesn't leave us anywhere to go.
He says, in the neurotic, in whom one sees the collapse of the whole human ideology of God, it has also become obvious what this signifies psychologically. The person becomes isolated. He's isolated in himself. Your problems are your own problems, you know. My problems are my own problems. They're so idiosyncratic. They're so personal. They're so weird and strange and result from my own personal history that you can't help me. Ultimately, you can't even know what my problems are because you're different. See? And I can't know yours. And therefore, we can't be in any kind of communion. See? It's like that's a possible direction that this analysis thing can go. We're cut off from communion with each other, and we're cut off from communion with God because somehow we just become a closed-in individual to whom no one or nothing can relate. It's all set, see? He says, if we're doing this, then we fail, then now, you know, we risk making the neurotic even worse off, he says, by closing him off from the larger worldview that he needs. Go.
Just a little bit. Who's the guy who keeps
quoting
from Kierkegaard. Yeah, okay. Just, I know kind of where... what's his name, the guy we're talking about.
Becker
is kind of coming from this history. Does Kierkegaard see, he sees, he talks about God as being the kind of the release of all our anxieties or whatever, right, through, is kind of curious, does Kierkegaard see God as the real release of our anxieties, I mean the guy who releases us, or does he see it as just something we kind of create to release our anxiety?
Okay, Becker might, you know, share in the last thing, but I think Kierkegaard does not. Kierkegaard, though I can't claim to really know about, he's a Danish theologian, 18, what year? 1813 to 1855, yeah. Someone says also that Becker quotes Kierkegaard very selectively because he maybe does not want to take everything that Kierkegaard said, but he only wants to take certain things. I don't know.
Okay, now which is which? So
Becker perhaps, when Becker does talk about the creative illusion, he does say, he almost makes it sound as though we need to get together to fool ourselves, you know. I don't know. I think, I'm not sure that he's quite square with himself at that point. But he does talk about that. He makes it sound as though we get together, you know, and sort of discuss how we're going to do this. But that doesn't square with what he's saying about the difficulty of it, for example, or the need to really believe. Because, you know, if we say we're going to make illusion and then believe in it, that obviously is not going to work. But sometimes he sort of verges on that in his language.
What you were saying earlier about psychology, about what psychology can do?
Yeah.
To put that in Fernier's terms, does that mean that psychologists can help you change your personage? You can't deal with the person?
It may. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
I was just catching a minister. I was trying to do a repeat of that too very well right now. But what was he saying?
False badness, he called it.
The false badness.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you know, what's your personage?
That may well be. I think maybe an example. I think maybe I come up with an idea or an example of false badness, okay? It's like it might be that as a child, say, you get the idea that something went wrong because you wished some bad thought. This is a fairly common thing, you know. Maybe you wished someone evil, you know, you wished some harm to come to somebody, and then something happened to them, and you feel like you did it by wishing it. And so you've got this load of guilt. Well, part of it's real because you really did wish, but part of it's false because your wish did not make it happen, say, if you accept that. So there'd be a false sort of a thing happening there, but perhaps a very small child doesn't know the difference, commonly claimed anyway, between wishing and acting. And so you'd be burdened down with that. And that, I think, would become hardened, possibly, into a character trait. And maybe analysis could break that trait, but it still wouldn't go back and address the child that thought that. That takes something else again, you know. I think that's a possible, you know, link-up, though. One more thing on the psychology thing, and then we're getting on to an hour here, but he talks in Denial of Death about transference. Transference in the original conception of it, I think was by Freud, he wanted his patients to come into him and be able to relate. Well, I guess maybe he didn't want it necessarily, but he found that it happened. His patients came in and began pouring their lives out, and suddenly he realized that they were relating to him as though he were a parent, for example. As though the therapist himself now becomes the power figure in this person's life, you know. You've got conflicts with your parents, you know, you go in and you talk to a therapist, and by, when the transference is in effect, you talk to the therapist in that way, and he, you know, and a real tug and pull begins to happen. This is transference. You transfer your thinking and your conflicts and all that onto the analyst. Then he says, so then he talks about how we do this to each other. Married people may do transference onto their spouse, for example, in expecting their spouse to be something that they wanted their parents to be but weren't, for example. And so you begin to relate to your spouse as though the spouse is mother or father. You may choose some other hero and begin to relate to that person. A member of my family, when John Kennedy was shot, was broken up as though, you know, a near member of the family had died. It was a personal tragedy, a disaster. And I think that was not that unusual. That would be a sort of a transference, you know, that Kennedy was carrying something for her besides just being, you know, president or something. Anyway, he says that the therapists often have a difficult time, what they call, terminating the transference. In other words, hopefully the patient is someday going to be able to walk out of the office, no longer doing this with a therapist, can go out and begin to behave in the real world, you know, like a whole person again, and no longer treating the therapist as though the therapist is a parent, for example. But they found that it's devilishly hard to terminate the transference. And Becker says, and I think he may quote also Otto Rank at this point, obviously it would be. And I think I can read a little passage, and he'll say it better than I can remember it. Okay. Psychoanalysis actually stultifies the emotional life of the patient. Man wants to focus his love on an absolute measure of power and value. Man wants to focus his love on an absolute measure of power and value. You know, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the analyst tells him that all is reducible to his early conditioning and is therefore relative. Man wants to find and experience the marvelous. And the analyst tells him how matter-of-fact everything is, how clinically explainable are our deepest ontological motives and guilts. Man is thereby deprived of the absolute mystery he needs, and the only omnipotent thing that then remains is the man who explained it away. And so the patient clings to the analyst with all his might. And that's a heck of a passage, isn't it? So these are some of his criticisms of a sort of a dominant ideology of our day. There's a lot more, but I feel like I have to stop because I'm not sure whether this is converging or whether it's diverging. And also, maybe other questions or comments or whatever. We can, you know, stop, and if people want to still talk, we can do that, and others can go if they want to. A comment about today's religion and the youth in the churches, which I thought I might like to tuck in just because it's sort of topical, maybe. This comes after his passage on religious heroism, the heroism of sainthood, where he went on to say, you know, but I'm not saying that the science of society is merging into organized religion. And then he talks about organized religion. He says, today religionists wonder why youth has abandoned the churches. not wanting to realize that it is precisely because organized religion openly subscribes to a commercial industrial hero system that is almost openly defunct. It so obviously denies reality, builds war machines against death, and banishes sacredness with bureaucratic dedication. Men are treated as things and the world is pulled down to their size. The churches subscribe to this empty heroics of possession, display, manipulation. I think that today Christianity is in trouble, not because its myths are dead, but because it does not offer its ideal of heroic sainthood as an immediate personal one to be lived by all believers. In a perverse way, the churches have turned their backs both on the miraculousness of creation and on the need to do something heroic in this world. And he continues a little more. He speaks of the early promise of Christianity, which he often does. He says this early promise was to bring about once and for all the social justice that the ancient world was crying for. We discussed this today and said, you know, is that all Christianity was? Well, no. But it certainly maybe looked like that, and to some it still does, and to some of us it seems like that probably is part of it anyway. Christianity never fulfilled this promise and is as far away from it today as ever, and that's in answer again to that thing about, you know, what we say and what we do. No wonder it has trouble being taken seriously as a hero system. Well, and then he says these problems are even becoming obvious to the organized religions themselves, which are wondering how to divorce themselves from defunct hero systems and recapture the imaginations and the heroic impulses that are stifled in the youth. One way, of course, is by a reaffirmation of traditional evangelism, which still seems to offer a way to overcome exaggerated fears of life and death by heroic dedication to special purity and worthiness. There is no easy way out of the dilemma. Organized society seems to represent a necessary denial of religious heroism, and he mentions Daniel Berrigan as an example. Society will move against religious sainthood when it poses a threat to its own system of heroic apotheosis, raising of man to godhood, no matter how self-defeating and immoral that system has become. Well, that's all really I'd thought to include. Maybe if a few of you have got your appetites whetted to do a little reading, that'll be make it worthwhile. He's really challenging. My initial impression when I started reading him was I did not want to continue. Because he just comes right inside me and immediately starts to, you know, sort of pull me apart to see what makes me really tick. And he comes just close enough, often enough, so that I had a real revulsion. But once I got hooked real good.